time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for September 28th, 2019. May I first take a moment to wish all of my Jewish friends and colleagues a very happy New Year. New Year begins Sunday at sundown. I hope all of you have a wonderful holiday season. This evening, we begin the show with Steve Frothingham. He's the editor of Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. As things get more crazy in Washington, there's a fourth tier of tariffs that have come down from the administration. I wanted to find out where the bicycle industry stands with those tariffs, and Steve always seems to know what's going on. After we take a break, we'll come back and we'll be speaking with Jeff Speck. Jeff is one of the most influential city planners working today. He was formerly the director of design at the National Endowment for the Arts, and his company, Speck & Associates, is a planning firm that serves both municipal and private clients. Jeff walks the walk and talks the talk, and he gives us a fascinating civics lesson in when and how communities thrive, how the environment is either supported or undermined, and where we find inequity in society. Oddly enough, we have a fairly deep discussion of parking and how it affects how cities thrive, and in fact, cities are not thriving. Making them more bikeable and walkable, though? Yes. Bicycles, walking, and public transit play a huge role in all of it. So first, let's head on out to Colorado to talk with Steve Frothingham about the bicycle industry and the tariffs. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Craziness in Washington. So,
well, on a number of fronts.
A number of fronts. Yeah. Well, but I thought it would be a good time to update on how tariffs are or aren't affecting the bike industry right now. It seems that things change day to day, and I really don't know what's going on. I don't know if anybody does. Do you know which tariffs are in place right now? What is under tariff regulations?
Oh, I think I do, but I think it would take more time than you want for me to explain all of it. There are still a lot of bicycle-related products that are under a 25% tariff. Set to increase to 30% on October 15th. These, of course, are all Chinese products. That's probably the biggest chunk, the biggest list of bicycle-related products. E-bikes are on another list. They got the tariff earlier. They got it at 25% last August 2018. And we can discuss that in a minute. They may or may not have escaped that tariff. Depending on how you interpret something that came out of the Trump administration late last week. There are some other items, I believe, that are still on a 25% list that was set to go up to 30% on October 15th. And then the last batch, what they call the fourth round or list number four, was basically everything else. It was, it really just hit everything coming out of China. The Trump administration said, okay, everything that wasn't on list number one through three is going to be on list four. And that's, you might have saw in the press that the president announced that, oh, we're going to delay that tariff until after the Christmas shopping season.
Right. I did see that.
What didn't get a lot of press, other than in the pages of Bicycle Retail and Industry News, is that that he split list four into list 4A and list 4B. List 4A contained all the bicycle products, and that list tariff began, I think, September 1st. So the bike industry did not get the Christmas gift that other industries
wow.
got.
Wow.
With the exception of balance bikes, which are considered a toy. And so that tariff was delayed until after the Christmas season.
When I first got into the business in the state of Ohio, bicycles were under a listing called toys. They were not considered sporting goods. This might be the only time ever that I wish it was still the same.
I know. I'm glad to hear you say that. I thought it was kind of ironic. I was waiting for someone to point that out in the comments on our website, and I didn't see anybody do that. But yeah, we, for some reason, we're not bicycles were not considered toys anymore on the import codes, with the exception of these little balance bikes.
Wow. So what has been exempted, if
well,
anything?
Last Friday, the administration released a list in the Federal Register. It's a little unclear. One thing that is clear right off the front was that single-speed road bikes, so basically bikes with wheels that are bigger than 26 inches and that have relatively narrow tires and that are single-speed. So basically we're talking about fixies
right.
here. And also some other, you know, kind of urban-y street adult single-speed bikes.
Track
bikes, I think. Yeah. They got excluded. And that means... Those bikes had been subject to a 10% tariff that began last September, right before Interbike, you might remember. And then that got increased to 25% in March and then was going to go up to 30% in October. And these particular bikes, just these narrow single-speed adult bikes, earned this exclusion, which means, number one, that companies that had been paying that extra tariff for the last year can get that money back.
No kidding.
Yeah, they haven't announced how that system is going to work, but theoretically they're going to be able to recover that money and that they're going to be able to import from here on out without paying that tariff, at least until next August when the exclusion expires. So that's big news for a few companies that are in that market. But even bigger news is on the same list that came out last Friday morning was an exclusion for an import code that may or may not include e-bikes. And it's, I might need a half an hour, Diane, to explain.
or a day or a
this.
Beer or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, can I say just say this, that I've been talking to people in the industry, I've been talking to people at People for Bikes, and even though it's been, coming up on a week now,
right.
The latest word I get is we don't know whether e-bikes really are subject to this exclusion or not.
Wow.
And I think I'm just not going to attempt to explain it.
Okay.
I think it would take me 20 minutes.
Wow.
Let's just say it's confusing and there's arguments to be made in either case and no one really has the answer yet. And that includes, People for Bikes who watches this stuff as closely as anybody and a few other experts, you probably know the names across the industry who watch this stuff. And none of them have been able to give me a straight answer yet. I just don't know. It would be huge news. I mean, that e-bike tariff has been a big factor. It's millions and millions of dollars that importers have been paying to import these bikes for the last year.
Lots of money involved. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Steve Frothingham. He is the editor, Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. And we talk to him periodically because he knows what's going on when I don't. Even if I do know what's going on, he knows better. So there was a bike brand who requested an exemption and got it. What was that?
Yeah, State Bicycle, which is a company that's been around for, I think, almost 10 years. They sell some interesting bikes almost all single-speed adult bikes that fall under that category we were just talking about.
Huh.
They sell primarily online through their website, but they also have a few hundred bike shops that they sell through as well. Inexpensive bikes, they sell a cyclocross bike that's a single-speed cyclocross bike that I think is $700. But neat brand. I've always liked them a bit, and their bikes are kind of classy looking. But they are one of a handful of companies that just filled out the form to request an exclusion from the tariffs, and they got it. And it's not just them. I mean, the exclusion applies to anybody who's bringing in that particular type of bike, single-speed adult road bikes. As of last Friday, when I checked, there had only been about 5 bike companies that had requested the exclusion. The others had not been denied yet, by the way. They were still in process, so they may either get the exclusion or they'll get denied. We'll see.
Wow.
And the request period is open until September 30th.
Which is this week.
Which is, this week. the last I checked a couple of days ago, I think there was another four or five names on the list. So I think people saw the news story last week and said, oh my God, we need to apply for that exemption as well. Exclusion, I should say. So we'll see. And I know that People for Bikes will make a request on behalf of the industry. And I think People for Bikes also is now urging specific companies to request specific exclusion for, narrow types of product rather than just saying, yes, can we just please get all bicycles off this list? It's more like, can we just get single speed bikes? Can we get carbon fiber forks off the list? I think I saw an accessory company requested, can we please remove, bike stands, storage stands from the list? So it's more narrow now.
I just got an email today, I think it is, that Bell Sports is going to raise prices. I mean, they just can't absorb it at this point, that now they're going to have to start passing on the price increases. Now, whether
right.
I'm not sure that it's 100% true or not, but that's what they're doing regardless.
Helmets had been excluded on the theory that they're safety products from lists 1 through 3. I think they originally were on one of the lists and they actually did get excluded in the process. But then on that list 4, the list that is essentially everything else, the Trump administration put helmets back in along with bicycle lights. My understanding is that, most of the helmets we're buying are made in China. So that makes sense.
This is the big picture question. What do you think we can expect over the next few months? We're approaching the holiday season. A lot of people do big business with bikes and accessories and apparel for holidays. What do you think?
You're not going to see a 25% increase on the sales floor for two reasons. One is that not everything we're buying is from China.
True.
And the other is that there's some softness in the system. The value, the exchange rate changes, and that reduces the impact somewhat. People are able to get concessions out of their suppliers in China saying, look, we can't do this. You need to lower your prices or we're not going to be able to do business with you anymore. So they'll squeeze their suppliers that way. And so, when you get on the sales floor, it's not like you're going to walk in and see everything in the stores all of a sudden increase 25%. But you might see things increased 10, 15%, and you might have a less healthy industry. You have suppliers and retailers who are squeezing all their margins to try to make all this happen. Not to mention the money they're spending trying to find new factories in other countries.
Well, true.
There's people flying around all over the world looking for new sources.
Yeah, trying to find new production
right.
facilities.
Right.
What about American manufacturers like, say, Paul? There are a few others, White Industries. There are some people who are actually making stuff here.
It's good news for them. I love it. there's a couple of interesting things there. One is that, Paul, if he competes with anyone, he's competing with, maybe Shimano and SRAM, and they don't manufacture in China.
Right.
SRAM is primarily in Taiwan. Shimano high-end stuff is made in Japan. Lower-end stuff is made in Malaysia, I think. So a lot of people forget that. It's a lot of the high-end stuff that a lot of you and I and the listeners to your show pay attention to is not coming from China. It tends to be the less expensive parts that are coming out of China, the stuff that goes into, the department stores and stuff.
Big buck.
But a lot of accessories and clothing and shoes and helmets and things like that do come from China. So, but that doesn't affect Paul so much. The other thing that's interesting about Paul, and I've written about this, is that there is still the tariff in place on aluminum and steel, and I believe still on bearings. So a lot of the stuff that Paul is making to build his hubs and other things that he makes has increased. His material costs have increased. So it's not all happy news for the Paul folks.
Well, I guess we'll leave it at that and check back. There's a lot of turmoil in Washington right now. For us, it doesn't seem like much of it's good as the bicycle business. So,
well, there's some bright spots, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. There are some bright spots.
A lot of cities and states that are increasing their facilities and improving their facilities, and bike use for transportation is increasing.
Oh, yeah.
E-bikes are wonderful things, and I think a lot of people are looking to replace their cars with e-bikes, and so there's some good stuff happening.
There is. And on that note, we'll end, and thank you. And we'll talk again soon. We'll keep checking back. All right, Steve. Steve Frothingham, editor of Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.
Steve Frothingham joined me to talk about tariffs. If you're interested in learning more, you can actually log on to bicycleretailerandindustrynews.com and read Steve's coverage of topics such as tariffs. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll head on down to Virginia to talk with Jeff Speck about walkable cities. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks. So I don't usually air the small talk that takes place before we actually begin recording for the show. But Jeff Speck sort of surprised me by asking me questions, and the interview just began to unfold without any formal introduction. So I was looking at the title of the book, just as an aside.
Can I interrupt before you start? I would be very interested if this could be as much a conversation as an interview, since you're in this space as well. If I ask you questions too, although maybe I need to know a little bit more about you to do that.
Sure.
But it'd be really fun if it was more of a conversation. But tell me, so who are you besides being an outspoken cyclist and apparently a bike shop owner?
Well, so when you say who am I guess 45 years in the bicycle business.
Okay.
I've written a book about taking a supported bike tour. I've been teaching yoga for the last 17 years.
Okay.
And I teach seniors mainly. So
okay.
The average age is 60.
Right.
And I'm a professional bike fitter. That's really where my work was when I was active in the bike shop pretty much 7 days a week. Now I'm a bike fitter when needed. My husband fits designs and builds custom bikes, both under his own name and then under people like Seven Cycles, Waterford, Calfee. So high-end bikes.
So if I want a bike from your shop, what would I pay?
Well, you know, that's always the question people ask. But the truth is that he'll tell you we can do something as inexpensive as $3,500.
Wow, that's a serious bike.
It is a serious bike, but it's not a racing bike. And that's where people sort of don't understand. It's a bike for people who ride a lot of miles, you know, who are going to ride either on paths or cross country or, you know, whatever you want to do with it, randonneuring. So it's all about you. It's not about the bike, but they are crafted, but one at a time. You know, it's only about you and your geometry and your fit. So yeah, they are not cheap.
You know, I'm kind of curious. I'm bike curious. That's good. I've been riding for 15 years on the same $300 Rally 300 that I bought in Washington, D.C. Lovely hybrid, nothing special about it. But it's just amazing to me how long a bike can last and how great a machine a simple bike is. And now I'm back from Copenhagen, which we can talk about, where, of course, the whole program is different. You know, the bike, the way that the bike is set up is so different. They're all quote unquote girls' bikes, as we used to call them.
Well, yeah, they're step throughs.
And the handlebars are high, and not just high, but close to you. So you're so upright. And I was wondering, you know, it's one of the windiest cities in the world, and yet they have that very vertical posture, which is so urban and civilized. But I am fascinated by the machine of the bike. I think it really is probably the best invention that we've made as humans.
From our perspective, we don't care about the cost of the bike. We happen to do high-end bikes, but our belief is if you get a bike that you like and that you'll ride, we don't care. They should last a long time. So when we build a bike for somebody who is looking to solve a specific issue, and that's usually what the problem is. It's usually a fit issue for somebody who's serious. But what you're talking about is a long-lasting steel bike, usually, that you can just get on day after day after day and ride as far as you need to ride. And I didn't realize Copenhagen was windy, though. And my guess is that it doesn't matter because you're not going so fast on the city streets.
Yeah, I think also that most of the places you ride are somewhat sheltered, if not with buildings, then with a lot of trees. So you're just not that exposed. But it was eye-opening And I know you're going to edit this and you can move things around. So this may be something that fits into a later topic, but it was really eye-opening. You hear so much about Copenhagen and you think you understand it, but then you go there and it was my first time. And for an American, it's just shocking. You know, they talk about Stockholm syndrome. I say that I've got Copenhagen syndrome. The definition of Copenhagen syndrome is you come back from Copenhagen and your own city looks like shit.
I totally get that, and I live in Cleveland, so you know we're struggling a lot to make a more bikeable and walkable city. So we haven't even welcomed you back to the show. For my listeners, it's Jeff Speck and I are talking. We're actually going to talk about his new bike, Walkable City Rules. And I,
you said bike, you meant book, I think.
Oh, we're going to talk about his new book because, of course, we've been talking about bikes. Yes, we are going to talk about his new book.
Bike on the train, as you should.
It's been since 2015, I think, that we talked. 2013. Okay. No, it was 2013 because it was almost 6 years ago when your first book came out, which I think was just called Walkable City, right?
Yeah, the subtitle was How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time.
Right. And this one is Walkable City Rules. Now, you can read that a couple of ways, and I realized that before we placed the call today. Walkable City Rules.
I asked Twitter if I should have an exclamation point. And
what did they say? No.
Overwhelmingly, they said no. That would have made it Walkable City Rules. But now I think without the exclamation point, it really is just Walkable City Rules. But I'm perfectly happy if someone wants to interpret it that way.
Okay. Absolutely. 101 Steps to Making Better Places. So, okay, I realize it has been 5 years. So it was 2013, I guess. Anyway, I want to go back to talking about what your concept of a walkable city is. And then we'll talk about some of the rules in the book. It's really interesting.
I try to define the walkable city as something that's achievable in the U.S., but also realistic comprehensively as in the context that many people drive. Certainly in America, the majority of people are driving, although actually a third of us aren't. We can talk about that another time. But that hoping that we're going to create cities in which nobody's driving, in which they're really walking cities and nothing else, is a bit of a pipe dream here. And so I define the walkable city as a city in which the automobile is available as a tool, as an optional instrument of freedom, but not as a prosthetic device, not something that you need just to live your daily life. And so a walkable city is really a place where you can make the choice to have a fruitful existence without suffering inordinately, you know, having access to all the things that you want and need without owning a car. Now, there's a flip side to that, of course, which is I'm describing this in terms of what you might consider elite projection, right? People like me who have the choice, who actually make enough money, you know, to make those sorts of choices. And I live in a, you know, I live in a city that is walkable. I also own a car because I want to have that freedom. But I should say that a ton of Americans don't have that choice. Many of them can't afford to drive, or they can't afford to drive, but they are driving, right? Many of us are burdened with owning a car who can't afford to own a car. According to the federal government, quote unquote, poor Americans are spending 40% of their income on transportation because we've burdened them with this extremely inefficient way to get around. And quote unquote, working Americans are spending about the same amount on transportation as they are on housing, and actually a little more on housing. So a little more on transportation than on housing. So I like to argue that we've made a choice, and that choice began, you know, in the 60s and 70s, but it's been reinforced year after year after year to artificially subsidize the use of automobiles in a way that allowed the automotive city to become the only city for so many people, while still not ultimately saving people any money. And back in the 70s, we spent 10% of our income on transportation. Now, overall, we spend 20% of our income on transportation. And that's the burden we've created by tying ourselves to this extremely expensive way of getting around.
Do you see anything changing given things such as the climate, oil prices, more young people not wanting to own a car, and are cities changing in a way that will support that?
Yes, absolutely. The problem is that there's a great mismatch between demand and supply. And so, you know, only 22% of American households are the type of households who traditionally want a house with a yard, two parents and at least one child, or a child and two parents. So that would be fine if that's – presuming these people really do want the kind of isolated suburban house as the goal, that would be fine if that was 22% of our supply. But in fact, about 65% of our supply is the isolated suburban house. So whenever you – given that the vast majority of households then don't really have a use for a big house or a big yard, or are even you know, holding school-age children in their homes, which has a huge influence on the decisions that people make about where to live. Given those circumstances, whenever you can provide the alternative in a walkable, safe, friendly place, it just gets bought through the roof. So the challenge isn't convincing people to live in more urban places. The challenge is that there aren't enough of them. And by urban, I simply mean walkable. I don't mean necessarily super dense or super you know, business-oriented or whatever. So in that context, you know, you've seen a big change, and I think everyone's aware of this. You've seen a big change in the last 20 years from downtowns as a place to avoid, or downtowns and surrounding neighborhoods as a place to avoid, to downtowns as the place where everyone wants to be. I would argue that if you're willing to change cities and move to some of our smaller and more up-and-coming cities, you know, like a Lowell, Massachusetts, or an Elkhart, Indiana, or other places that maybe you haven't heard of, that sort of walkable urbanism is quite available. But of course, most people are stuck in the metro areas that they're in. They're not really prepared to just pick it all up, leave their friends and family behind. And so as you look metro area to metro area, you have this challenge where there's just an incredible scarcity of the walkable urbanism, as much of it as we make.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jeff Speck. His new book, Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places, is what we're talking about. But we're talking about it in a much broader sense. I do want to ask a couple of questions and bring up some of the things in the book.
And one can of, I say, though?
Absolutely.
I want to interrupt you to say that that circumstance that I described is the, you know, is the life force behind the work that so many of us do, which is basically to make more places like that. So my colleagues and I, you know, my firm, but many other firms, we basically have this two-pronged strategy of making existing places more walkable, and particularly cities, downtowns, and mid-sized and smaller cities, downtowns, where most Americans are living near, you know, not the few famous big cities that you always hear about, but all the other cities across the U.S., making them more walkable and more bikeable, because that's part of the same package. And then also to create new places that are based on the traditional model of the, you know, networked town, city, village, but essentially on transit. So TOD, transit-oriented development, a lot of the place where we're focusing our efforts is to find those train stations, either new or pre-existing, that have areas around them that are empty or underdeveloped, of which there are very many. I'm working on one right now in Newton, Massachusetts, which is a 1,000-car parking lot, right, surface parking lot. There are so many of these underutilized sites surrounding transit that can become the locations of whole new communities, which is the one sustainable way to build new places. Of course, the most sustainable thing is to reinvest in older places, but we have this two-pronged strategy. We've really given up on stopping sprawl. At least I have. Like, I co-wrote a book with my mentors, Andre Stuani and Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg, back in 2000, called Suburban Nation. And when we wrote Suburban Nation, at least I had this hope that we could turn the ship around and just kind of stop America from sprawling. But I've lost all hope that can be stopped for many reasons that we can get into. But sprawl will continue because so many markets exist, so many subsidies exist to support it, and so many businesses and corporations benefit from it, and so many developers and financiers live on it. I think sprawl is going to keep going. But if we can make places that provide people an alternative to sprawl, then we've done a lot of good for a lot of people. We've also lightened the footprint of a lot of people.
Experiencing sprawl here where we live, which is a community outside of Cleveland, it's one of the ring suburbs. And to see what this city has done, which is a lot of, I think they've made a lot of huge mistakes, including bringing in a Walmart, tearing down acres and acres of old forest, just things that didn't make sense and made it less walkable, less bikeable, less enticing to an upscale citizenship, an upscale group of people. So that now it's attracting people who can only afford to go to Walmart, for example. So it's kind of sad. It's kind of sad. So you talk
I should say I have some experience in Cleveland lecturing at the wonderful Old Stone Church for Reverend Mark Giuliano.
Yeah, downtown. Sure, I know who.
Yeah, he's a huge advocate of great cities and has become a good friend. And I see him frequently. Real advocacy for urban living, urban thinking. And of course, right on your newly remade city square, which I haven't visited since it was done, but I hear it's turned out pretty well.
It did turn out pretty well. It was done for the Republican National Convention, so they hurried it up and finished it.
Okay, well, whatever it takes.
Right, exactly.
And there's been a lot of great stuff happening downtown. But also when I was there, I spoke at Cleveland State because they chose my book, Walkable City, as a campus read, an all-campus read, which is, of course, as an author, makes your heart sing. But when I was speaking there, the DOT, state DOT, was moving forward with a new kind of cross-county connector kind of highway that I think may be under construction now that just looked really pathetic and horrible. Do you know if that happened?
Yeah. 480. Oh, 490. Yeah. No. You know what? It's a small section, and it's been under construction. I don't know when you spoke here, but that whole area is still a mess. They insisted on building the football stadium back down on the lakefront, taking away from what is one of the most beautiful lakefronts. You know, the only reason you go down there is 13 times a year to watch a football game, which I hate to say this on the air, but I don't care. I'd much rather be able to bike through there. So, you know, whatever. I don't know. Let's talk a second about your book. You talk about selling walkability. And so what actually sells the concept, and who do you have to sell it to make it happen?
Well, you'd be surprised how the folks who come to my lectures, and every month or so I'm lecturing somewhere in the U.S. to usually about 200 to 300 people. Bigger cities, I get more. But a typical city is like, I was in Honolulu last week, lucky me, and we had 350 people show up just to hear about, you know, making Honolulu more walkable. So, you know, we had a nice crowd there. But the people who come to these events are usually the people who are already sold, right? So,
yeah, right. It's preaching to the choir is what we say, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of what we call the automotive hordes who take a lot of arm twisting and need to understand because, you know, most of us, speaking for myself, we're cyclists, but we're also pedestrians, we're also transit takers, and we're also drivers.
Right.
Most of us Americans, it's really important. In fact, in planning school, they teach you to say people walking, people driving, people biking, and not pedestrians, cyclists, because we're all the same people, and most of us are the same. One person doing all those different things. So there's hope for everyone, but people can be empathetic to each other's position. But there's a lot of people who might otherwise kind of, you know, unthinkingly join the automotive hordes when the automotive hordes are saying, we can't possibly lose a lane for cycling or for a dedicated busway. We can't possibly lose a parking space for a bike corral or a line of parking spaces for a bike lane. These folks can be made to think differently, or they can be influenced, is a better word, to think differently. But I've found that the planning arguments, the historical planning arguments, which are more social and design-oriented arguments, aren't that effective. And so I actually talk about selling walkability in terms of five other ways to sell it. And by selling it, I mean convincing people to
of course.
Want it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in Walkable City, I identified three of them, which were basically the economical, the health, and the environmental reasons why our society or our cities should be more walkable. Since then, I identified, I mean, we were talking about them before, but I hadn't really had the data or the conviction to include them. But I've subsequently collected data, and with data comes conviction, to talk about equity, which is super important, and community, which actually for some time it's been demonstrated that walkable places generate a ton more community than non-walkable places. So I'm not going to go into each of these because it's a long conversation if I start. But my overriding point is that there are great economic arguments for walkability that are much more convincing than planning arguments. And I already gave you some of them regarding what we're spending of our income on transportation when we don't need to be. The environmental movement is fascinating because it historically in the U.S. has been an anti-city movement. And when we started mapping carbon, not per square mile, but per household, carbon footprint per household, you become very pro-city because the maps flip and the greenest places in the country are the densest places in the country. So, you know, as Ed Glaser says, we're a destructive species. If you love nature, just stay the hell away from it. Live in a city, the denser, the better. The health arguments you've heard before surround not just obesity and obesity-related illnesses, which are a huge function of the inactivity that comes from having designed out of existence the useful walk, but also 40,000 people dead each year in car crashes, many multiples of that permanently injured in car crashes, an asthma rate that is three times what it was in the 90s and focused mostly around heavily trafficked roadways, and any number of other maladies that are a direct result of how much we're driving, how much time we're stuck in our cars, how much time we're near cars. And there's a lot more to say about that, but I'll jump quickly to equity. One shocking thing that people don't realize that you can use in your work, people think about cycling as an elitist activity or an elite activity. And if you sell $5,000 bikes, maybe it is, but fully 39% of the people who bike to work in this country are from the lowest 25% of income earners.
Yes.
So investment in bike facilities is investment in the people who have the least. So it's a real equity conversation. Similarly, you're much more likely to be hit by a car and killed or injured if you are old, if you are of color, if you are from an underserved community. And of course, the people who rely the most on transit are poorer citizens. I think people often get a little bit confused about different modes of transportation. And I've learned from my experience, and the data is very clear, that basically your city can trend in one of two directions. You can have a city that supports transit and biking and walking. And all three of those things support each other, which of course are the three things available to people with less money. Then you can have a society that supports driving. If your society supports driving, it is actively undermining transit and walking and biking. So it isn't like there's four modes to juggle. It's three modes that support each other and one mode that's completely self-supporting and destructive to the others. The community aspect, there's a whole bunch of data in this. Robert Putnam, when he wrote Bowling Alone, asked why, he's a demographer at Harvard, he asked why we have such a decline of civic discourse and public participation, statistically demonstrated decline in public participation in the U.S., and he found no single factor more indicative than the length of your commute. So if you add 10 minutes to your commute, you're 10% less likely to participate in community events in your town, which makes sense because we only have so much time. There was also Donald Appleyard's amazing studies from the 80s where he looked at similar apartments and row houses on similar streets where the only difference was the amount of traffic flow. And he polled hundreds and hundreds of residents and asked them to define their home turf, like how big is it? And the people who lived on the less traveled streets, their home turf was the whole block. And the people who lived on the heavily traveled streets, their whole home turf was their apartment, basically. And he asked them how many friends they had. And the people who lived on the lighter traveled streets averaged 3.2 friends. And the people who lived on the heavily traveled streets average 0.9 friends. So
interesting.
I like to say, you know, that's hardly the best ad copy. You know, heavily right. traveled streets for those days when you want to have slightly less than one friend.
It's an interesting concept. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Jeff Speck. We were going to be talking about his book. We'll talk about his book at the end of our conversation because the book is pretty much talking about what you can do to make your city walkable, but that doesn't mean it isn't bikeable or public transit. One of the things that you talk about is parking, and I thought that was interesting, about getting parking right.
Yeah, so I'm a student of Donald Shoup.
Okay.
And basically everything I know about parking that isn't from my own personal experience, I learned from the dean of American parking, whose name is Donald Shoup.
Well, I hope he didn't design most parking lots because they're terrible.
Right. Now, he's got like 3 PhDs from MIT. He's taught for many years, I think, at UCLA. And he's largely retired, but he's still travels around, and I heard him lecture as recently as June when he brought the house down at the Congress for New Urbanism annual meeting. And he's just such a delightful gentleman, but he's really figured parking out. And the way that I describe it is that until he came along, basically we were asking the wrong question about parking in our cities, which was, how can we have enough? And if you ask that question, you never satisfyingly answer it for a deep economical reason, which we won't get into, but it's a reason that pertains also to driving, which is basically that it's dramatically underpriced. And because it's underpriced, it's what economists call a free good. And if something's a free good, if you're not paying the proper price for something, then you can't ever satisfy demand. The thing planners say was, you know, of course there's not enough parking. If pizza were free, would there be enough pizza?
Right.
So under those conditions, he's asked a different question. The question he asks is, in so many words, how can we provide, design, and manage parking in a way that our cities thrive? And if you ask the question that way, it's an entirely different answer. You know, that's the question cities should be asking, because cities want to thrive, right? If you ask the question that way, you get an entirely different answer. And that answer includes eliminating the on-site parking requirement. So no one business or residential, you know, building or anyone else has to supply their own parking, because that just creates an unwalkable environment. Parking should be managed collectively. Secondarily, to charge the right price for parking. So to charge enough for parking either at the curb or in a communal lot such that there are always spaces available. And if you price it right so there's always spaces available, then shops succeed and, you know, people can function properly, make the proper decisions, and not circle hours upon hours to find a spot when there are none. And he cited the case of Westwood, California, in their downtown, where he charted, I think, close to 90% of the traffic was people circling trying to find parking spaces because the parking was free, and so there wasn't any available. And then the third leg of Don Shoup's stool is called the Parking Benefits District. And the Parking Benefits District is a response to the fact that merchants hate the idea of charging the right price for parking. Merchants always think that if you raise the price of curb parking to the right price, which results in, let's say, one vacancy per curb face per block, if you do that, then no one will ever come there again. So what they had to do in Pasadena, and they've subsequently done in a lot of places, is you tell the merchants and other local landowners, every extra dollar we earn by properly pricing parking, and we'll earn a lot, we'll go to your sidewalks, your street trees, your store facades. In Pasadena, they turn their rear alley system into a pedestrian walking system. There's no dumpsters in Pasadena because each block has its own central trash compacting facility. They basically spent all the extra money earned by charging the right price for parking on making the place better, which of course made more people want to come, which caused more crowding, which caused the price of the parking to go up. And it's this virtuous cycle now. And one of the outcomes is that it's much more walkable, and many more people now are choosing to live there walking and biking and not driving there and trying to find a parking space.
Wow. So interesting, Jeff. So interesting.
And that's all stuff I learned from him, but I'm very happy to steal the best ideas.
Of course.
Share them.
Well, I don't think that he would consider it stealing.
He actually edited my chapter in Walkable City, which was based on his book, so he was very gentle.
I can believe that. There are so many rules in the book. I wish we could talk about them all. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was you have your last chapter. So there are 19 chapters in the book. And again, we can't possibly talk about them all in this conversation. But it's titled Do It Now. What are some of the things we can do now?
Well, the whole, yeah, the chapter is a collection of rules that all add up to immediate opportunities. I should step back for a second to say that unlike Walkable City, which was basically, you know, literary nonfiction for people who like to read about cities, Walkable City Rules is much more of a manual, much more of a handbook. It is 101 rules, each one of which is two pages and begins with a headline, a subheadline, and there's a picture or a chart or a graph or two and a caption. And then at the end, there's an actual rule that says, do this, don't do that. And it's extraordinarily specific. And some of it's a little bit unorthodox, but it's all things that I have absolute confidence in. The Do It Now chapter, which I don't have in front of me, talks about the work that cities are doing as we speak, much of which I've been involved in. And I would say most places, particularly somewhat urban places or downtown places, where walkability is the most possible, the thing that they can do the quickest and the most effectively is restripe their streets. And of course, half the book is about what's between the curbs. The other half isn't, but the stuff between the curbs can be redone expensively and slowly with reconstruction, with new sidewalks, with, you know, a rebuilt downtown core. And I've done those plans. I designed a plan for downtown Oklahoma City for their 40-block Central Business District where they had $200 million to spend. So they actually rebuilt every street in their downtown core. That's an anomalous condition, right? The typical condition is a city that's barely keeping up with its repaving and filling the potholes, and they need to know what to do. And a much more typical experience I had is working with Cedar Rapids, where Cedar Rapids wanted what Oklahoma City had, but they didn't have the budget. And they basically, again, commissioned a redesign of their downtown streets, but they said, we're just going to repaint when we repave, and we're going to repave the streets according to the existing schedule of a street or two a year. And it actually took them about 6 or 7 years, but they've now totally reconfigured their downtown core based on a plan that I helped develop. I designed it, but then they changed it a bit. So it's a mutual effort in which we took a half one-way system and made it all two-way because two-way streets are much safer. We added about 60% more on-street parking because they just had too much pavement that we had to use up. So we turned a lot of parallel parking into angle parking. And we took a bike network that was almost non-existent and put a comprehensive bicycle network in there, including, you know, protected buffered lanes and other things like that. But the asphalt on your ground is money in the bank that you can use for different ways. Most cities, even if they're congested, have many streets that aren't congested and many opportunities, if you look at it network-wide and not just street by street by street, many opportunities for inserting bike lanes, for reducing the number of driving lanes to the amount that's needed to hold the current traffic. And by the way, it's almost, I want to talk about this a little bit more, but it's almost impossible to reduce supply of lanes below the demand that's placed on them by traffic. Like, as much as I'd like to, yes, I'll admit it, to go into a city and say, even a progressive city like Boston, to go into a city like Boston and say, we want to be a green city. We're a Kyoto Accord city. We know we have to reduce driving. We want to encourage the use of other modes. So we should actively be reducing the number of driving lanes, even below the current traffic, you know, the current traffic demands. That's impossible. There's no city in the U.S. where I've been able to do that, where I've been able to say, you know, your car counts demand this many lanes of traffic, and we're going to supply fewer because we want fewer drivers. That's impossible. So what you do instead is you find those streets or those places where locally there's more supply than demand. And I've done this all over the place in Cedar Rapids, in Oklahoma City, in Lowell, Massachusetts, in Hammond, Indiana, where you can reduce the number of driving lanes simply because actually you have certain streets that have more lanes of supply than cars of demand, right? And then you do that. And you end up with all this extra asphalt. Another super easy win is a lot of cities have lanes that are 11, 12, 13, 14 feet wide, and a lane should only be 10 feet wide. NACTO, the National Association of City Transportation Officials, has a 10-foot lane standard. And this is, of course, a busy downtown commercial lane. In residential neighborhoods, they can be much narrower. But a busy downtown commercial lane should be a 10-foot lane. If you've got a street with three 14-foot lanes, actually, you've got room there for wonderful bike facility if you just make the lanes the right width.
Right.
So that's also money in the bank for making your city better. And then there's neat little tricks like turning a four-laner into a three-laner. A three-lane street in which the middle lane is a reversible left-turn lane actually handles as much traffic as a four-lane street. It's bizarre, but four-lane streets, in addition to being super dangerous, are super inefficient. And I have a list of 20, there's a lot more now, but I have a list of 23 different four to three lane road diets across the US where it's demonstrated that the car capacity did not drop one iota. So there's all these tricks for taking asphalt away from cars in ways that do not make it more congested for cars and transferring them to more sustainable modes of transport, principally bikes, but also helping merchants with more parking where that makes sense. And that's, you can do it with just paint. And that's why cities that want to be more walkable or they just want to protect themselves from being overrun by traffic are making these changes very quickly all over the U.S.
This will probably be the last time I say we've been talking with Jeff Speck. We're going to start wrapping it up. And at some point, I want to be able, in fact, let's do it right now. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Jeff. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We've been talking with Jeff Speck. If you're just joining us, we are talking about making your city more walkable, bikeable, transitable, if you want to talk about that. Yeah, it's my new word for the day. So let's take a step back. If we don't start looking at some of these ideas, what are we facing?
You know, I'm not the person to ask about the larger societal apocalypse that we seem to be facing.
You know, are you sure?
I do believe that everything we can do in terms of prevention, in terms of mitigation, right, every little bit helps. I'm not going to talk about doom and gloom because that can be disempowering. What I have found, though, is I think people talk about walkability and bikeability and drivability of their cities in a confusingly binary way. They actually think that their city is either a walkable city or a drivable city, when in fact it's a spectrum and every city exists somewhere along that spectrum. Everything you can do that makes it more walkable and more bikeable and makes the transit better, reduces your carbon footprint, makes your residents healthier, improves your economic circumstances and improves your quality of life and your community and improves equity, right? These five things I talked about. So every little thing you can do makes a difference. And where you are on that spectrum is a good indication of how you're going to perform in terms of all those other metrics. And it's not a choice of A or B or black or white. It's just let's all do as well as we can.
Geez, I don't even know where to go from here. It's just been such an amazing conversation. Huh? Good luck. Good luck with that. Yeah. Well, the book again is called Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. It's by Jeff Speck. We have spoken with him in the past about his original book called Walkable Cities. And this book is laid out in such an interesting way. And it's, you could just like pick any page, turn existing corridors into bike paths. I mean, that works for me. Turn the page, adopt a 10-foot standard for free flow lanes, something we just talked about. Understand network functions. So it's all in there. There are rules. There are 101. Are there 101 rules or are there more?
There are exactly
101.
I hate to say this, and it was not my intention, but I've discovered this is the best book to have by your toilet.
Oh, I love, everybody loves potty reading, you know? Everybody loves that. Everybody has a place for that in their house. What's wrong with that?
All you need is two pages at a time. And, you know, every rule is self-sufficient. Now, it is grouped into chapters. You know, one chapter is all about about building cycle facilities. I think another chapter is about creating a cycling city and, you know, avoiding certain mishaps that cities make. Other chapters are about understanding really how traffic works and not making dumb mistakes in allowing the fear of traffic to create your city or to create the design of your city. But each rule really is standalone, and everyone has a role to play.
And that's really the important part, that we can all do something. I believe that. Where can people get copies of the book, Jeff?
I like IndieBound, which links people to their independent bookstores. But, of course, it is at barnesandnoble.com. It's on amazon.com. Your local bookstore will order it for you if they don't have it. It's about a year old now. May not still be in your local bookstore, but they'd be happy to get it for you. And it's in a lot of libraries. And honestly, I don't mind if people just beg, borrow, or steal it. It's also on audible.com.
Oh, okay.
Like Walkable City, I got to do the voice, which is fun and tiring.
Well, you have a decent voice to listen to. I like it. I mean, you make it interesting to hear what you have to say. First of all, you know exactly what it's all about. You really understand the issues. So having somebody just voice it who doesn't get it isn't going to give it that same kind of input.
I wasn't going to have someone mispronouncing Shoop or anything else in the book.
You mean like Robert Redford or somebody like
right. Right. He offered, but yeah.
He did. Of course he did.
So it's much more of a book for doers. If you are a activist, if you're a planning board member, God forbid if you're a professional planner or designer, but if you're someone who actually wants to show up at City Hall and have enlightened arguments to make about why that bike lane is important, or why we need to fund transit better, or why we shouldn't stop people of lower incomes from moving into a neighborhood near us, you know, the information is all there. Walkable City, in contrast, is really for convincing people who maybe aren't yet there about why these things are important, and just for getting people who wouldn't necessarily be excited about the whole topic to enjoy the public discourse on planning. And I should say, as kind of a bit of a wrap up, that the, you know, I've never been about walking or about walkability or, you know, this physical activity of moving your legs as a focus in my work. It's just that I've discovered it's the best way to sell good planning. It's the best way to communicate good planning. It took me a long time. You know, we didn't refer to walking or walkability very much in our work at all, until we discovered that actually everything we do is designed to make walking better, and that people really get it when you frame best practices in city planning in terms of walkability. It makes sense to folks. Now, this had a bit of an echo effect or a rebound, I don't know what you would call it, effect. But once we did that, then we were able to step back and realize, actually, you make a lot better decisions. If you yourself think of it that way as a planner, you make a lot better decisions if walkability is your North Star. So it has turned out to be the term of art that I'm going to keep using until someone tells me I can't.
Well, this is interesting. We happened to watch, which we'd never seen before, and we had been told to watch it, a documentary called Supersize Me, about who took 30 days to eat nothing but McDonald's three times a day. And I looked at my husband after it was done, and I said, you know, the people who are going to watch this already know about how bad this is going to be. It's the people who aren't going to watch it. This is preaching to the choir. So one of the things I always hope when I have conversations like the one we just are having and have had today is that somebody who might not have thought about it the way we've talked about it gets it differently and shares that. And yeah, so, absolutely. You know, that's what we can hope for. Well, Jeff, this has been, as always, delightful. Where are you headed next?
Oh boy. Well, I'm just back from Honolulu, Salt Lake City, Austin, and before that, Copenhagen and Hamburg. But my next trip is to lovely Northwestern Indiana, where I'm speaking at a luncheon relating to the work I'm doing in a little town in once the second largest city in Indiana, Hammond, Indiana.
I've heard of Hammond. Yeah.
It's a Chicago suburb. It's the home of the guy who wrote A Christmas Story, which is kind of modeled on Hammond, which was once this amazing, bustling city that was brought down by the same thing that brought down every American city, so that the main street now is largely dead. And there's still a lot of good stuff and nice people and even wealth in the city, but they've pretty much abandoned their main street. However, thanks to a real effort, both from regional actors and from local leadership, they're about to get a new train station that will connect them quickly with the loop of Chicago.
Wow.
That's going to fundamentally change the nature of the downtown.
Right.
And so the question is, what can you do to both better integrate the train station into the main street, but then also transform the main street in a way that it's a place where people want to be? Because currently it isn't, for multiple reasons, mostly that it's overrun with speeding cars. How do we make the right design changes to cause the train station to cause the downtown to come back? So it's a fascinating
challenge. It's like a focal point that suddenly expands into a whole new way of thinking about downtown. That's really cool. Hammond, Indiana, huh?
Yeah, you watch this space.
Watch this space. Well, thank you, Jeff. Thanks so much for writing the book. Thanks for talking with me today. And we will talk again, I am sure.
Well, thank you for your caring about these issues and for your advocacy in general on this subject matter. I think it's great. We need more outspoken cyclists, but until we have more, you can be the lead.
Oh, thank you. All right. Have a great day.
Okay.
You too. All right. Bye. Jeff Speck joined me to talk about Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. We talked about an awful lot of stuff. If you're interested in knowing more about Jeff and his work, you can log on to jeffspeck.com. My thanks to Jeff and to Steve Frothingham for joining me this week. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. You can leave a comment on our blog at OutspokenCyclist.com. You can also help to sponsor the Outspoken Cyclist at OutspokenCyclist.com by pushing the little button that says Push Me and donating. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe out there. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.